Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on April 21st of 2019 under the headline Missing Trapper's Mom Suspected Foul Play. Here we go. As the first day of March 1924 arrived, L. Sarah Wilson's worry and alarm mounted. Something had happened, something bad. Her son, 36-year-old Harry Roy Wilson, had promised he'd be back at her home in Bend sometime in February. Roy was a former U.S. Marine, 8th Regiment, 1917 to 1919, and his word was solid gold. If he didn't do what he said he was going to do, it was because he couldn't. Roy's mother was convinced that he hadn't come to Bend because he'd been murdered. Roy was a logger who worked for Brooks Scanlon Lumber Company of Bend. Late the previous year, he and a co-worker, 23-year-old Dewey Morris, had agreed to spend the winter at a remote cabin by Big Lava Lake with another one-time co-worker, 53-year-old Edward Nichols. Nichols was spending the winter at the cabin tending to the cabin owner's small fur farm of silver foxes in exchange for a piece of the action when the furs were sold. The job promised to be a pleasant one. The foxes didn't require too much care. They had to be fed each day, of course, and their water kept topped up and unfrozen, but that was about it. Meanwhile, the three men were free to run trap lines for the wild foxes and martens and other valuable fur-bearing animals around the lake. Nichols was particularly keen to have company for the winter, and especially the company of a trained warrior like Wilson, because there was some bad blood between him and a former partner, Lee Collins. This man, Collins, was a somewhat slow-witted fellow from Idaho who had the habit of talking rapidly through his teeth while affecting a toothy and insincere smile, like a fast-talking Jack Nicholson character. He had spent the previous winter at the cabin helping Nichols tend to the fox farm. At the end of their partnership, though, the fur markets were at a low point and the fox farm's owner decided to wait to sell the furs until prices were better. Collins, who of course wanted his money immediately, interpreted this as an attempt by Nichols and the owner to cheat him out of his share. So, happening to know where Nichols had $500 stashed near the cabin, he stole it and disappeared. When Nichols reported this crime, investigators told him that Collins wasn't the man's real name. He was actually Charles Hyde Kimsey, a convict who had recently escaped from the Idaho State Pen, where he had been serving a 14-year sentence for burglary. With the help of the information Nichols gave the police, Kimsey was tracked down and they very nearly caught him. But after he slipped out of their clutches, knowing who had ratted him out, Kimsey made it very clear that he would now be gunning for Edward Nichols. And of course, Kimsey would know exactly where to go to find Nichols, since the cabin and fox farm hadn't gone anywhere. Plus, if he waited to take his revenge until the dead of winter, he'd also be able to steal the fox pelts, valued at about $1,800, plus whatever else Nichols might have found on his trap line that winter. Revenge for the ratting out, plus a nice wad of cash? A tempting prospect for a felon on the run. So with this in mind, Nichols got his two friends to come out to the cabin with him, and they settled in for the winter. On January 15th, 1924, Alan Wilcoxon, a neighboring trapper and friend of both Nichols and Collins, came by and spent the night in the cabin with the three men. He was the last person ever to have seen them alive, other than their killers. Time went by. Winter ripened into early spring. February 29th, it was a leap year, came, and with it, no sign of Wilson. Sarah Wilson would not be comforted. Other relatives assured her that the boys were probably just fine, maybe snowed in at one of the shelter shacks along their trap line. No big deal. No sale. Sarah Wilson was convinced that something awful had happened to her son and his friends. Finally, a couple of family members saddled up and made the trip out to Lava Lakes for a visit. They arrived on April 13th. What they found there certainly gave them reason to worry that Sarah might be right. The cabin had been unoccupied for some time. The wall calendar still had the January leaf showing. The last meal eaten in the place appeared to have been breakfast, and no one had bothered to clean up or put away dishes. And the whole cabin was in a very unkempt condition, which is not at all in character with how Nichols, Morris, and especially ex-Marine Wilson kept their things. That could have been explained away, conceivably. After the three men left for whatever reason, a traveler might have come by and, finding the cabin vacant, lived in it for a few days. But where the men might have gone was another tricky question. Their bedrolls, most of their heavy winter clothing, and all but two of their guns, a Colt 22 revolver and Wilson's war souvenir Luger automatic, were still in the cabin. Where would the three of them have gone without heavy coats or firearms? There was a meal out for the farm foxes, but the foxes were gone. Had they escaped? Or had someone stolen them? The visitors made the rounds of the boys' trap line. They found the corpses of several martens and wild foxes in the traps. The animals had sprung the traps and then, stuck in them, died of thirst. Yet there were no pelts in the cabin. Had they not been running their trap line, or had someone stolen all their pelts? Answers were not slow in coming to light. On April 20th, the visitors found a big spot of blood in the snow. It was sandwiched between a lower and upper layer of clean white stuff, as if it had been spilled and frozen several weeks or months earlier. There were also tracks, visible despite an inch or two of snow having fallen since they were made, of a heavily laden sled having been pulled away across the snow in the direction of Big Lava Lake. Following those tracks, the investigators found that they went out onto the frozen lake and ended at a spot where someone had chopped a hole in the ice, a hole just big enough to slip a body through. And caught in a crack in the ice near the edge was a medium-length strand of sandy brown human hair. Then someone found the missing foxes. They'd been killed, skinned, and hidden in the bushes. There was no longer any room for doubt. The three trappers had clearly been murdered, and the motive was either robbery or revenge. Or maybe both. A few days later, Portland furrier Carl Schumacher, having seen the coverage of the mystery in the Portland Morning Oregonian, contacted the police to report that a man had brought four fox pelts into his shop on January 22nd, 7 days after the three men had last been seen alive. Schumacher remembered the situation well because the pelts had been mishandled. The trapper, who stayed and chatted with him for half an hour or so about various trapper-related things and seemed to be an old hand at the game, apparently didn't know how to properly stretch and cure a valuable pelt, and although the pelts weren't ruined, they had lost considerable value as a result. By the time Schumacher contacted the cops, they were already looking into Charles Hyde Kimsey as a suspect. They showed Schumacher a photograph. Schumacher said he couldn't give a positive ID, but the photo definitely looked like it could be the same man. But Kimsey was still on the lam. There was still no sign of him when, a month or two later, the ice in the lake melted, and all three bodies were found floating in it. Police lassoed them and towed them to shore. The evidence they found on the bodies put to rest any lingering doubts about whether or not they'd been murdered. We'll talk about that, and the efforts to figure out who did it, in next week's column. Key sources in this column included works by Melanie Tupper, Tyler Wilford, and the archives of the Portland Morning Oregonian, April and May 1924. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 700 stories originally created and published as newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. Other Offbeat Oregon goodies include an active Facebook page, a ton of historic photos, and a bunch more stuff, including visuals for today's show and full citations to sources, all accessible via our hub page at offbeatoregon.com. By the way, if you like this kind of stuff, you might be interested in my other podcast. It's called The Penny Dreadful Story Hour, and it's basically an early Victorian variety show. I read a chapter from each of six classic Penny Dreadful story papers published between 1840 and 1866 with historical and sociological commentary and definitions of the flash cant slang lingo used by Romany family coves and bold highway robbers and titled Regency roisterers and such. The Dreadfuls we're working through right now are Sweeney Todd, Highwayman Dick Turpin, Varney the Vampire, an international espionage series called The Black Band, and a couple other whacking great stories. Check it out. You'll find it wherever you get your podcasts, or you can cut straight to it at pulp-lit.com/pennydread. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and learn more at atlasstringband.com. Questions, critiques, ideas for a future episode? Email me at fj@offbeatoregon.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.